Tammy Haddad. Thank you for joining us. We're talking with two of the funniest, smartest guys to ever put words in a president's mouth, Jon Favreau and John Lovett. Mr. Favreau is the former director of speech writing for President Barack Obama. He joined the White House after working on the 2004 John Kerry presidential campaign. He was one of the youngest speech writers on record. He left in 2013 and created Fenway Strategies with his White House colleague Tommy Viator, and they're now in Hollywood. Mr. Lovett was speechwriter to Senator Hillary Clinton, working both in her Senate office and on her presidential campaign before joining the Obama White House. He spent 3 years drafting speeches and, yes, crafting jokes for President Barack Obama before setting his sights on Hollywood. He co-created and wrote the NBC sitcom 1600 Penn and was a producer on the HBO show The Newsroom. He is now working on a pilot for Showtime. Gentlemen, thank you for joining us. Please tell us first about meeting President Barack Obama. Jon Favreau?
The first time I met President Obama was in 2004, right before he delivered the convention speech at the Democratic Convention in Boston. And at the time I was working for John Kerry's campaign. I was a deputy speechwriter. My job at the convention was to be backstage and look at all the different speeches that were being delivered and make sure they were on the message of the Kerry campaign. So one day I get a call from the road and someone tells me that there's a line in Barack Obama's convention speech that John Kerry wants to use in his convention speech. And so I said, okay, well, what do you want me to do about it? And they told me that my job was to walk down the hall where Barack Obama was practicing his convention speech for the very first time and tell him he had to take out the line. So I walk down the hall, I'm like 21 years old at the time, and walk into this room where Obama's practicing, and I see Robert Gibbs, who used to be my boss in the Kerry campaign. So I go up to him and I was like, oh, would you mind telling Senator Obama that he has to change this line because John Kerry wants to use it? And Gibbs looks at me and he's like, oh, I'm not telling him, you go tell him. So I have to walk up to Barack Obama, tell him that he should change this line. And he basically like came to within an inch of my face, stared down at me, and then I think I blacked out for a couple seconds. And finally, that's when I met David Axelrod. He was in the room, and he said, you know, let's just walk outside, and you and I we can rewrite the line for him. And so that was my first impression with the boss, which was a really great one. And I thought I would never see him or talk to him after that, but you know, a while later when Kerry lost the race and Obama won his Senate race, Gibbs reached out and said he needed a speechwriter, and I interviewed with Obama, and the best part of the interview was the fact that he forgot that I was the one who took out the line all those months earlier. So saved me at the end of the day.
I met the president right after he was inaugurated when I started working at the White House. John had brought me on. I was a speechwriter for then Senator Clinton till the end of her campaign in her Senate office. And I came on board, and I remember when I went in and met him for the first time, he said, he laughed when he saw me, and he said that I made Favreau look like a grizzled veteran, which I took as a compliment.
That's good. That's good.
How do you write a speech for a president? Is it separate? Do you work together?
We sort of split up the speeches mostly, but when there were big speeches, we would always collaborate. Usually the process with the president works, you know, where if it's a big speech, we will meet with him in the Oval and he'll talk for, you know, 20 to 30 minutes about what's on his mind, what he wants to say on the speech. And then the speechwriting team will sort of go back to our office. We'll talk through, you know, our own ideas for the speech. We'll kind of make sure everyone kind of gets their say. And then, you know, one of us will go ahead and draft the speech. We send it around to edits internally with the speechwriting team first. And then we send it out to the White House and then ultimately the president. And then it's just a process of going back and forth with him. You know, there are times when he just marks up an entire speech with black pen and a whole bunch of edits. And that's usually, that's the good news. The bad news is when he doesn't do anything to the speech. And that's usually because he wants us to start again. So you know, it depends on the different on what the speech is.
And do you have a quote person there? Is there one person that pulls those great quotes?
we have a researcher, sort of like the assistant to the speechwriting office, also doubles as a researcher. And we've had, you know, when we started at the White House, it was a young man named Kyle O'Connor who went on to be a speechwriter. And then throughout most of the time that I was there, it was a young woman named Laura, Laura Dean. And they were both just fantastic at this. They would research quotes. They would find great anecdotes. They'd, like, scour local news stories for, you know, really good, good kind of powerful, moving anecdotes. So, yeah, we had people on tap to do all that good stuff.
So, John Lovett, you get assigned the White House Correspondents' Dinner presidential speech. And what is the first thing you do? Do you go drinking?
Yeah.
Do you go stand at the Washington Monument?
Usually,
what do you do?
Well, the process for the Correspondents' Dinner speeches are a little bit different. Usually, we start a conversation about topics. It's usually me and John and David Axelrod. More recently, a guy named David Litt would join in a part of that process, and other speechwriters, Cody Keenan, who's now chief speechwriter. A lot of people will just start thinking about topics and areas that we want to cover. What's been in the news? What's been ridiculous? What's been absurd? What's something that's been bothering us about the way the president's been covered, or something about him that we want to make fun of?
Cultural moments.
Yeah, like... right. You know, pop culture stuff. I think we've made Kardashian jokes in the past.
Yeah, that's evergreen.
And we start generating just a very long list of topics, and then we'll kind of go to our separate corners, and we'll just start generating jokes, as many jokes as we can, try to hit at least one joke per topic, or as many jokes as you can write in the span of a couple days. Then we'll collect those jokes from everybody internally, plus we'll send requests to funny people in the from outside that we think could be great contributors. You know, somebody like Judd Apatow has written incredibly funny things for us.
Yeah. It's like the most fun part of this process for us is that being in the White House, we've had access to all these unbelievably funny people, right?
Yeah.
So writers from The Daily Show, writers from SNL, Judd Apatow, Jay Leno writers. I mean, we had so many people who would just... And sometimes they reached out to us and said, oh, we know you guys are doing jokes, and can we contribute some? And so we've gotten some really great jokes just from all over the place.
Do you feel obligated to use it?
No.
If Judd Apatow sends you a joke, how do you say, hey, Judd, I know you're funny, you've made millions of dollars, I'd love to work on one of your movies, but we're not taking it.
Luckily, that hasn't been that big of a problem, but like anything, I mean, all these people that submit jokes, they're professional comedy writers. They know that for every good joke, there were four that you had to write that weren't as good to get you there. So everybody's pretty understanding of the process. And usually, you know, we take all this stuff and we end up with four, five, six times the amount of material we'll end up needing. And over the next week, 2 weeks, including meeting with the president, we'll start culling that down. And by the time you get to the end of the process, you have no idea who's written what. It's gone through so many changes. You've internalized it. You've moved things around. You've figured out new ways to shape material to make it work for the moment. And by the end, you have something more cohesive that everybody really did together, I think.
Yeah, you actually totally forget who wrote what joke.
I literally
when
people
laugh at them, and then we
I wrote
take
every
credit
joke.
For all of them.
I think I wrote every joke. By the end of the process, I wrote every joke.
Yeah.
That's usually the way that I feel.
The funny comedians.
Well, that's why you're in Hollywood now.
No, I... Yeah,
that's one,
I wrote
yeah, that's one, you could say that. That's
yeah, that's
one
right. Yeah, you could say
that. We'll go with that.
Sure, that's it.
So tell us about the famous dinner where Seth Meyers performed and Donald Trump was in the audience. Take us inside the room that night.
We should start before that.
Yeah, let's start,
before that.
So basically what happens is this dinner was right around the moment where Donald Trump, in all his wisdom, sent a team of investigators to Hawaii to uncover the president's long-form birth certificate. Like, this was a thing that happened.
I forgot that this part happened.
Yeah, so we were like, okay, number one on the agenda for this speech is we're going to make a bunch of birth certificate jokes, and we also find out that Donald Trump's going to be at the dinner, so we were, like, ready to go. So we have a couple bits. We have the opening when the president comes out. We have Hulk Hogan's Real America theme song playing.
But we had a whole bunch of stuff that we were planning on doing before we found out that we had the birth certificate.
Well, yeah, so we have all these bits planned, and then we find out, then Dan Pfeiffer, like a couple days before the dinner, like brings us into his office, and he's like, so I have to tell you, like the president's lawyer is on a plane to Hawaii
before that happened, we had written all this material, and when you were telling us that something strange was happening and you were going to go meet and find out about some weird thing that you didn't really fully understand, we're like, we were joking, like, oh, maybe they got the real birth certificate. We're going to have to throw out all this material. We couldn't believe that it actually was happening and 3 days before the dinner.
And our first instinct was like, I can't believe this. This is now that we actually have the birth certificate, this is going to ruin all the jokes. And then we calmed down and we realized that getting the birth certificate is actually
made
perfect.
It so much better.
So now, the big bit that we have is this video where President's going to go out on stage and say, you know, as you know, this week we uncovered my long-form birth certificate, and tonight I'd like to also announce that we've also uncovered my live birth video. And then up on the screen, they play the opening scenes from The Lion King when they hold Simba up. And, you know, we have like a little record button in the corner so it looks like a birth video.
Now, I warn you, no one has seen this footage in 50 years, not even me. But let's take a look.
And then we also had, this is a joke from Judd Apatow that gave us this whole great, you have to tell this joke because I can't remember.
Yeah, it was basically just ripping Donald Trump apart.
All kidding aside, obviously we all know about your credentials and breadth of experience. For example, no, seriously, just recently, in an episode of Celebrity Apprentice, at the steakhouse, the men's cooking team did not impress the judges from Omaha Steaks. And there was a lot of blame to go around, but you, Mr. Trump, recognized that the real problem was a lack of leadership. And so ultimately, you didn't blame Little John or Meatloaf. You fired Gary Busey. And these are the kind of decisions that would keep me up at night.
We tore him to pieces. And we had all this material ready to go to show the president because a lot of it we had changed or whipped up just in the previous 3 days since we had met with him because the birth certificate had actually come out. It's the Friday before the dinner, which is on Saturday.
No, it's Saturday morning.
No, but before that, we could not get time on Friday because a bunch of stuff is happening. His day got moved around. And so our usual meeting, which it should have been on Thursday or Friday beforehand, gets pushed to 2 hours or 3 hours before the dinner. And we have a video and stuff. If he doesn't like it or we need to make changes, we were really in trouble. And so
we walk into the outer oval, and Katie Johnson, who's the president's personal secretary at the time, said, you know, he's in there, and he is on the phone with a general in Afghanistan, and so we're going to have to push your meeting, and you guys are just going to have to wait out here. And the two of us were like, oh, my God.
How it's so important.
This is so awful.
How can you?
We have a walkthrough at the Hilton.
Don't you understand?
What's going on?
The dinner is tonight.
So we're like, well, Katie, we'll show you our Lion King video because we're very excited about it. You know, yeah. So we start playing the Lion King video on Katie's computer in the outer oval. And there's a guy from the NSC who's like the chief counterterrorism guy at the NSC.
He looks very serious.
We thought,
let's cheer him up with some jokes, you know, but he wasn't biting.
Was not laughing at the video. And so finally, the president, you know, waves us all in. He comes out. He's like, okay, here's the deal.
As relaxed as could be, by the way.
Yeah, totally. He's like, I love all these jokes. I think everything's great. I'm ready to go tonight. I have one edit. It's like, there is a bit where you guys talk about how, you know, my name's Barack Hussein Obama, but did you know that there's a lot of Republican candidates in 2012 who have middle names that are also going to get them in trouble? Like, you know, did you know that his real name is Governor Tim Bin Laden Pawlenty? And so Obama looks at us and he's like, here's the thing.
Fine joke.
Yeah, he's like,
not our best.
Not great, but fine. So he's like, here's the thing. I would just get rid of Bin Laden and go with another bad guy. And we're like, why would we do that? And he's like, I just think Bin Laden's been done. It's old. He's like, let's go with Tim Hosni Pawlenty. That's going to be much funnier. Like, after Hosni Mubarak.
Sort of like, I don't know that it is, but you won the votes.
I was like, well, that's not funny at all, you know? And he's like, no, trust me. It's going to be better that way.
But thankfully, he didn't throw out. He liked everything else that we had done, so we were
so we changed
counting
it,
our blessings and got out of there.
Enjoy your Tim Pawlenty joke.
Yeah,
and that
fine.
Was it.
Tim Pawlenty? He seems all-American. But if you heard his real middle name, Tim Hosni Pawlenty? What a shame.
One other thing happened is he had he called me right before the dinner, and he was like, oh, could you also make sure that, he goes, I'm probably going to remember this on my own, but just in case, the very end of the speech, I want to say, you know, God bless America, and may God bless our troops and keep them safe. And I thought that was kind of an odd ending to add at a correspondence dinner. So he goes to the dinner. I ended up sitting at a table right behind Trump. Trump is furious because in addition to Obama destroying him, Seth Meyers does an unbelievable job of destroying him as well. And we find out the next day that the general that the president was on the phone with was the one where he gave the order to have the Bin Laden mission.
And that night was the night of the Bin Laden raid, and that's why he wanted to change the joke. And so the thing I think it was me, you, and Axelrod in that meeting.
Yep.
And we realized after was that like we were these three idiot comedy writers in the middle of like the most serious thing.
And it turned out the only person that had a worse night than Bin Laden was Donald Trump.
I wouldn't compare them.
That is true.
I wouldn't compare them.
It's a joke.
It's a joke. It's allowed.
We're kidding. It's we're out of the White House.
We don't work in politics anymore.
Well, it was an incredible night. But how do you write these jokes? How do you structure them in a way that doesn't give away the president's standing? I mean, what is that measurement? This is a little too far. He won't look presidential.
I think the most important rule is he never punches down. You know, he never kicks people while they're down, really. I mean, occasionally, you know, if a big person in the media or some big figure has had like a really rough press period because he or she has deserved it, then that's fair game. But for the most part, you know, I think we stick to the rule that, you know, making fun of the powerful is satire and making fun of the powerless is bullying. And we just live by that rule. And by the way, he wants this as well, is that they're smart and hard-edged
and self-deprecating
and his point of view. And I think there's nothing that's not presidential about that.
It's also, I mean, he has a certain brand of humor, right? Where like he doesn't do like a lot of, you know, knock-knock jokes, punchlines.
Yeah,
right?
He's not doing impressions up there.
His brand of humor is making fun of the absurdity of the political process and Washington and the media, right? Like, he actually believes it's absurd. So it sort of helps that most of the jokes are, he does sarcasm very well, and they're sort of like, you know, letting everyone know that he realizes that this whole thing is sort of silly,
yeah,
and he pokes fun at that, right? And so knowing that that's like his general sphere of humor, it sort of is easier to then find jokes that fit within that theme.
You know? I think that's right.
Do you think it humanizes him? I mean, not just for this president, but previous presidents? And before you started writing these, did you go and look at previous dinners, previous presidents?
We've done that. I mean, you go back and look at them either online, if some of them are available, or you go back and read old speeches. But the truth is, they're not that instructive. Actually, what's funny is you go back and look at them from even 2 or 3 years ago, and they're jokes you don't even understand anymore because they were so topical at the time. And there are evergreen ones that either because they poked fun at some quality that has lasted as part of their reputation, or it's some more evergreen topic. But they're actually not that instructive. It really is about finding the tone and issues and stuff of the moment. I'll use a word like zeitgeist. You know, that's a word I'd use.
It's your choice.
I'm not gonna. I don't use it.
So, like, no, I think this is a very interesting point, because as we are coming up with jokes, a lot of times we have a test where we're like, you know, is this joke too insidery for the dinner, right? Because the jokes that get, even though it's Washington and you think it's an insidery crowd, the jokes that get the biggest laughs are the jokes where, if you haven't been paying attention to politics that much, you could still get the joke.
Yeah.
And what's interesting is, I think the comedians that come to the dinner sometimes, the ones who are the most successful are the comedians who tell those evergreen jokes,
right,
and not the comedians who come there and think, this is a DC crowd, so I've got to scour the news and find the most insidery political joke possible. Like, it's usually the evergreen jokes for the broadest audience possible that are the best jokes.
Yeah, I mean, I think we've struck a really good balance over the years. It's a mix of insidery jokes, a mix of cultural jokes, a mix of just jokes about him as a person that anybody who's had a television or a phone in the last 8 years would get. Plus, we mix in, I think, you know, we some of it's self-deprecating, some of it's sharper than others. I think my instinct is to create jokes that are the equivalent of like knocking the podium over and yelling with anger. So, but we, you know, and we temper those, and because it's actually a really, the crowd itself is really diverse in every way except the way that matters. But no, but it's diverse in terms of some people are DC people and political. Some of them are, you know,
some
Hollywood,
people are rich Washington people,
rich Hollywood people. Yeah, right. Rich advertisers, all kinds of different, sort of a cross section of America's wealthy show up at this thing. And because we care so much about catering to them, we try to really hit every target, you know?
Yes, that's very good.
Are you playing to the room, all those folks in the room, or are you playing to the audience at home?
I think both.
Yeah.
I mean, that's the sweet spot is a joke where you think to yourself, okay, is the celebrity who's there going to laugh at this? Is the Washington journalist there going to laugh at this? And then is someone from home going to laugh at
it? But actually, right? I mean, I think, you know, jokes aside about catering to the room, the truth is we write this to, that we think it's funny, right?
Right.
I mean, so often the jokes that we think are the best jokes that we've put in this year are not the ones that get the biggest response in the crowd. It's the ones we thought were okay, or maybe a little sillier, maybe a little broader, whatever. Yeah. And so ultimately, I think, I don't give a lot of thought anyway when I'm trying to write a joke about, oh, what will this do on YouTube, or who in the crowd will like this? You're just trying to come up with what you think is funny, and hopefully what you think is funny, other people are going to find funny too.
Well, and to that end, we send these jokes around to so many people. Like, everyone who runs into us, you know, unfortunately for them, has to listen to our jokes before the dinner, because we just want to test them out. And if there's a joke that the two of us like, that, you know, 10 people we've told don't think it's funny, we usually take it out.
Yeah.
Because
although occasionally, this is staying
this
in.
Is staying
it's staying.
In.
I don't care.
If I laugh, that's all that matters.
Pearls before swine. This is a great joke, I'll say.
So that happens sometimes.
I can be strident sometimes.
And what about the comedians? You started talking about them. They come in, they roll in, but some of the biggest names have totally flopped in the room. Do you guys ever help them? Can you explain why they sometimes flop?
We don't help them.
No.
We've never helped them.
But I think there have been flops. But for the most part, I think there are people that have ranged from doing okay to doing really, really well. Like, I think Seth Meyers
Seth
is one
best.
Of the best that we saw. I think it's really, really hard. First of all, you're following the president of the United States. That's insane. That's an insane thing to do. Also, you know, the bar...
It's lower for president.
And you know, President Obama is genuinely funny. He's not funny for a politician. He has a great sense of humor. He has a great delivery. And even in the writing process, his instincts are not to be careful or cautious. His instincts are to be as sharp and funny as possible. And so that gives us a real advantage. And so these comics from whom people expect a lot have to also follow the president. Also, by the way, this is a room full of people eating dessert. And they've been there for 2.5 hours, and it's a huge, huge room. And even though it's got, I don't know how many thousand people are in there, they're spread out. So it's actually really, you know, I think that there have been comedians who have done better in the room than it seemed, for whether it's people watching on C-SPAN or people watching it on YouTube, because the room, it is hard to pick up the laughs, and it just, you can lose the space, I think, really easily.
Yeah. I mean, there's very few, I don't remember a time where I just didn't laugh. I mean, I laughed through just about every comedian speech that I've seen in all the years that I've been there.
Yeah. I mean, the thing Seth Meyers did that was really awesome is he just hit so many jokes so quickly that it really kept people laughing, which actually was a good strategy.
Right.
Did you ever see President Bush, President George W. Bush's first speech? It was right after the recount. And Ozzy Osbourne was in the audience. And there was a moment there where he made reference to Ozzy Osbourne, the last person you would expect President Bush to make reference to. Osbourne jumps on the table, and it changed the whole atmosphere around the White House. Do you think about how you want people to feel about the president after the dinner, or you're just making jokes?
We just want people to think he was funny, you know?
Yeah,
he came, he brought it, he had a good... We want people to think he had a good time.
Yeah, I think the more you want to get out of this, the less you will. I don't think there's the right way to think about this at all. First of all, you know...
There's no strategy going into it.
By the way, you think about this dinner too much, you kind of think it's terrible. So so best not to do that.
There's no politics that goes into it in terms of, like, what do we need to get out of this? What does the president need to hit to help himself? Like,
yeah, I mean,
have to do that. You know, there's so many other times that you have to do that this is the one time where you're just like, the test is it funny?
And also, by the way, and also just to make sure that he's always gone up there with like a lot of class. You know, he'll make fun of himself just as much as he'll make fun of the audience and the press. He'll make fun of Democrats as much as he'll make fun of Republicans, which I think is the most honorable way to approach this, and that's the way we do it. And I think that if it achieves anything, it shows people he has a sense of humor, it's endearing, and takes a couple of shots at people who deserve it.
Yeah.
Do you think he's comfortable when the comedian makes fun of him? It's always interesting to watch on C-SPAN and see the comedian who looks incredibly uncomfortable next to the president. But this president looks like it's just another day that he's, you know, that this person's taken him on and it's okay. Or how does he feel?
So I think he's fine with it when people make fun of him. But I think the more uncomfortable thing is he's thinking to himself, well, everyone's looking at how I'm going to be reacting to this joke. So he has to make sure he's laughing, you know. But he doesn't. Knowing him, he doesn't care at all.
Yeah, and also I think I've watched every one of these things. And I think everybody has, people have gone at him pretty hard. But everybody's pretty respectful of the president. I know that there have been times before this administration where comedians have gone, you know, into areas people were a bit uncomfortable with.
I've always thought that someone was going to land a harder hit on him, and I don't think anyone's landed a real tough one.
No.
Let's talk about the relationship between Hollywood and Washington, which is at its apex the weekend of the White House Correspondents' Dinner, where there are stars everywhere, the White House, the bowling alley, Correspondents' Dinner. Why do you think that relationship got so important?
I don't know if it's important. Yeah, it's just there.
Yeah. I don't know why this has happened. I'm sure it's because, you know, our society is hurtling towards some kind of oblivion. But
to put a positive spin on it.
Yeah. I'm sure it has to do with the dynamics going on in what these journalistic institutions are competing for in terms of prestige and audience. But
there's also all these shows, John, and you had a show on NBC.
I did.
When people are turning to Washington, they're really interested.
I don't know what makes this moment particularly ripe for political comedies or political dramas. I don't mind it. It seems good for me. But I think part of it is that I think everybody's looking to find places where they can tell stories with outcomes that really matter. And I think everybody comes to a political show with an understanding that there are these built-in consequences for the decisions these people make, whether it's a more cynical and dramatic version like House of Cards, or a satirical version like Veep, or, you know, a hit comedy version like 1600 Pen. called classic, like 1600
Pen. Let me know when I'm supposed to laugh at that.
I was waiting. But whatever type of show people love, 1600 Pen, House of Cards,
those two
and others.
The same, yeah.
I think that people know that this world matters, that the decisions these people make matters. I think it's actually for the same reason you see medical shows, the same reason you see legal shows. The personal flaws and choices and conflicts of these individuals have real ramifications for other people in their lives, and people like seeing those stakes, I think. You know, you hear that. That's like a buzzword you hear out here. You hear people talk about stakes all the time. And
you hear people talk about buzzwords.
You hear people talk about zeitgeist. And the buzzword is one of the zeitgeist. I'm done. Next.
I was just going to say, I mean, I think that over the last decade, couple decades maybe, politics has been covered as entertainment, right? And we, and the media treats politicians like, you know, they're looking into their private lives, and it's all about the character and the individual, and it's less about the policy debates and the institution. And so as that's how politics is covered, then I think it's a more of a natural segue into actual entertainment, right?
Yeah, and I think part of it too is, I think everybody's wrestling with their dissatisfaction with the political order, their mm-hmm. sense that these people are craven buffoons and whatever. I think the culture is trying to figure out what's broken. Why do these institutions not seem trustworthy anymore? Why does Congress not seem like it works anymore? Why is there so much contentiousness?
Lovett's pitching his show now.
I'm pitching a show. Just, like to pitch your show.
No, but five but more minutes but, be done.
And you'll buy it. I think people are, you know, I think the culture is trying to figure out what's going on. So I think it's not surprising that people in entertainment who are part of that culture are trying to find ways to answer that question. And you see cynical takes, and you see comedy, you know, comedic takes, but I think that's part of it, and I think that's what this moment is about in part, I guess.
And how different is it living there versus living in Washington and working at the White House?
It, What's been great is there are entire weeks where I will never turn on cable news, and so I don't know what's going on there.
Yeah.
I still check Twitter, you know, constantly, so I get my fill of headlines in the morning.
But the best thing about being on the West Coast is by the time you've gotten, if you check your phone, check Twitter at 10 a.m., you've missed a whole stupid news cycle.
You've missed like four controversies that have come and passed.
Yeah, people are making jokes about how tired they are of something we're just learning about.
The pace is definitely slower out here. I mean, even in whatever business you're doing, you know, we do speeches, whether you're doing writing in Hollywood, like it's just... You know, it is a slower pace. Things aren't like 24/7 news cycle crazy. You know, it's just it's peaceful. But so you trade a little excitement for peace.
But don't you feel like you have to explain Washington to Hollywood when you're there? Don't people ask you what it's like?
I do get a lot of, you know, for people who don't know Washington that well, like, oh, is it like House of Cards? And I'm like, no, it's not like House of Cards in any way.
I find that people say they want to ask you about it, but really what they want to do is tell you what you think, what they think. And that's easy. You could just listen.
Yeah.
So when are we going to see your next show? When is your House of Cards? Anyone want to give us any hint?
Nope. As soon as possible. I feel like I am figuring out this new kind of career as I go. So your guess is as good as mine, but
I'm just waiting for Lovett to do it first, and then we're just going to, he's the guinea pig, and then we'll.
Sure.
John, we should ask you about working with Aaron Sorkin. I mean, you went from the White House to your own show and then Aaron Sorkin. Those are pretty big steps. There you were on The Newsroom in the last season, which I thought was incredible.
Well, thanks. I mean, I jumped at the chance. I mean, I went into politics in part because of The West Wing. I watched the first season of West Wing when I was a senior in high school, and then I made my entire suite watch the second season right around the time of Bush versus Gore, actually. And in the back of my mind, I always thought, oh, that, you know, those speechwriters, like, that's something to aspire to. And then it happened in part because I loved that show and tried that path because of it. So to be able to then go and work with him and see how he operates was, you know, a dream come true, a phrase I wouldn't say out loud but until now.
There you go.
How about that? I put a little spin on it, though.
You guys rock. Thank you. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Tammy.
No problem.
For Washington Insider, I'm Tammy Haddad. Thanks for joining us. Please note our program is in no way affiliated with the White House Correspondents Association. Our views are our own. If you liked what you heard, be sure to subscribe to our podcast and keep an eye out for more episodes coming soon. Co-executive producer Julie Donofrio and Haddad Media. These programs are produced in conjunction with Simon Marks and the Feature Story News team, including Rob Flynn. Special thanks to White House Photos and WhiteHouse.gov